So Arun's going to give a guest lecture today. He's going to finish our CUDA performance section. But before he does so, I want to just go back over radix sort really quick. Not the parallel part. But I just want to talk about sorting ascending and descending, right? Because I asked that question last class. So say I just gave you input of size 4, right? And this is really 3, 1, 2, 0. And we're sorting ascending, right? So we started with the least significant bit, and we partition zeros and ones. So we said, here's these two have zeros, so they come over here. These two have ones in the least significant bit, so they go to the right. And then we move one bit to the left. So now we're going to look really, since we just have two bits, we're going to look at the most significant bit. And again, we'll partition zeros to the left and ones to the right. So here we get 0, 0. Then here we get 0, 1. And then we get ones to the right. Sorry. 1, 0, 1, 1. So we get 0, 1, 2, 3, right, ascending. And then I said, well, how do we do this descending, right? And the answer I had in my head was you flip the partition. So instead of putting zeros to the left, where you wind up with smaller and smaller numbers, you put ones to the right, ones to the left. So let me show you an example of doing that. We'll take the same input. Now we're partition the least significant bit. We're going to take ones and put them on the left. That thing is already partitioned. Do you guys see that? So I'll just rewrite it. Now, if we were to move to the most significant bit and put and take the ones to the left, so now you get 1, 1, 1, 0, and then you get 0, 1, 0, 0. So now you get 3, 2, 1, 0. Really, so if we switch from going from partitioning 0 to the left, 1 to the right, we just switch it to 1 to the right, 0 to the left, now you get descending, right? And then the question came up, well, what if I went, instead of going from least significant bit to most significant bit, what if I went in the opposite direction, most significant bit to least significant bit? Does that sort it, right? Do you guys have intuition here as to if that's actually going to sort it or not? So you said that it would.
But now looking at this, I don't think it will be.
Okay, so let's go through an example and let's try it. Okay, so again, we're going to take the same input, and let's start with the most significant bit, and we're going to take the zeros and put them on the left-hand side. So we're going to take 0, 1, 0, 0, and then we're going to take the ones, which is 1, 1, and 10. Okay. Now, let's move to the next bit, which in this case now is our least significant bit. Zeros on the left. 0, 0, 1, 0, and then 1's on the right, 0, 1, 1, 1. So we're going to have 0, 2, 1, 3. All right, so it didn't sort it. So this is probably a legitimate counterexample proof where that does not work. What I showed you previously is like proof by example, which is not proof at all, right? But I'm pretty confident that it works, and if I were an analysis guy, I could probably write a proof, or any analysis people in the room could write a proof for it. So it simply just depends on if you're partitioning based on zeros going to the left or ones going to the right, given ascending or descending. You do another example on your own to convince yourself. So do you guys have any other questions about radix sort? Okay, good. So with that, then I'm going to give Ryan the floor. He's going to continue the CUDA performance discussion. And if you have any questions on the homework, Veruda is the person to go to.
Okay. So as Patrick said, we're going to continue discussing the objective of improving CUDA performance. So this talk is split up into a couple of pieces. First thing we're going to cover is optimizations in terms of reorganizing the instructions, so the actual CUDA code. And the latter half, we're going to be discussing different optimizations when using memory, such as shared memory, and a little bit about global memory as well. And then we're going to wrap up with CUDA streams, which allow you to mix and match what you do at different points. The first topic I wanted to cover was mixed instructions. what we received so far was typical floating point instructions such as add and multiply. But if you wanted to do something more complicated like sine or exponentials, you can do it in two different ways. One is using the standard math libraries and just doing it that way, and you will get full precision in terms of the floating point accuracy, but it'll be much slower. And on earlier CUDA slides, you might have seen these functions, sinef and expf, which are intrinsic functions that are built into the CUDA math libraries. And what they allow you to use is these little units called SFUs. And these are special function units. Another point I should make is that this diagram right here might not be something that you've seen before. And this is actually the streaming multiprocessor for Fermi, which is the GTX 480 and above. And there's a couple of reasons why I showed this. One is that I couldn't find a really good picture of the G80 to use instead. And the other is that a lot of the optimizations that we're going to talk about today change depending on which architecture that you're using. So, for example, a lot of you might actually have 480s or higher inside your PCs, and therefore the optimizations that you use will have to be tweaked because of different architecture. You can see, for instance, that this guy has 32 SPs inside an SM versus the 8 you saw in a G80 or a GT200. So that changes that execution. In a later lecture, we'll talk a lot more about how Fermi changes things in regards to CUDA, and then we'll also talk about different architectures too. But the main point I wanted to get across here, at least, is that whenever you're scheduling instructions, mixed instructions like sinef and expf, you have to watch out that you only have 4 of these SFUs versus in Fermi, you'd actually have 16 CUDA cores to execute a warp at any given time. So this will slow down your performance. And you can also share them between the two modules here. So you have to watch out for that as well. Okay, the next big topic I want to cover was loop unrolling. And to start with, we can see this is a very simple loop here that's part of the matrix multiply program that you've seen. And this is the part that's just computing the dot product. So we have a floating point multiply here to do that, the part of the dot product, and then the sum to add it onto the overall. Are there any other instructions that you see that are actually part of this loop? Anything else?
The increment and compare.
Right. So we have a loop counter that's incrementing upwards, and then we also have a branch instruction at the top. And there's actually one more thing. If you were to write this in assembly, what else would you have to do? This one's a little trickier, I suppose. I'm sorry? Well, that's not part of the loop per se, since you only have to do it once. One other thing? You have to compute the addresses and do the load for MS and NS. The particular element that you want. Since it's a 2D array, you have to do actually some address arithmetic in order to get the value that you want. Okay, so what we really have here are two floating point arithmetic instructions. We have the add and the multiply, we have a branch, we have two address arithmetic instructions, and a loop counter increment instruction. So right here, we have a total of 6 instructions. That means only 2 out of the 6 were actually floating point computations. Whenever we measure performance for these guys, we measure in gigaflops, floating point operations per second. So we're wasting a lot of time by doing instructions that are not contributing to increasing our flops count. In Fermi's case, that would be a full teraflop of performance if you push it all the way. So the idea that we have here instead is something called loop unrolling. And what we do is that instead of actually having a loop, we write down all of the instructions one by one all the way. If that block size was 16, for instance, then we'd simply have 16 increments and multiplies in a row. And that way, we don't have any branching, incrementing for the counter, And we also don't have to do the address arithmetic because now we're holding k constant for each level. So we only have to do the one tx or ty sum. Any questions about this? A nice part is that the CUDA compiler could actually do this automatically for you. So there's a pragma called unroll And you can either specify by the amount you want to unroll it, or if you just leave it off, it'll unroll the whole thing for you. Now, under the hood to do something like this, it actually uses predication for small branches or standard branches for when there's many instructions underneath the if. Can anybody think of any disadvantages to using unrolling them?
Code size.
Yes, code size would definitely be a problem. There's a secondary concern that comes up with having code size. Assuming we have a ton of code memory, code size isn't directly a problem. But what could that lead to in terms of performance? Yeah, you have to fetch it. And that in turn, Fermi and others actually have instruction caches, so we can have more instruction cache misses because we have more instructions. Another thing is, I think somebody said it, is that this would use a lot more registers. Because we have to do that sum and multiply now 16 times in a row, we can't reuse the registers. And so we're going to have a lot more register pressure on that front. If we're also using automatic unrolling, then we have the whole predication thing too. And that's going to tack on extra bits to every instruction because they're all conditional. And so that could cause further instruction cache misses as well. Any questions about this? And this is an interesting note I found. And what do you think? So we have a simple loop here where we have some offset. And as you've seen probably with the parallel reduction code, you're multiplying the loop counter by some stride and then using that as an index. Any opinions on whether the loop counter here should be signed or unsigned? Any thoughts? How many think unsigned? Okay. What's the rationale behind that?
Well, it doesn't go to anything. I mean, that's the only reason I think.
Okay. Anyone think signed? So this is a very interesting optimization note because it's really weird, but on the other hand, it's very simple to do, is that if you make your loop counter signed, then because of the fact that C overflow for assigned number is undefined, the compiler can actually do additional optimizations. So one optimization it can do is that because it knows this thing won't overflow, then it might be able to turn that multiply into a shift or something else. And also, if the thing was looping from less than or equal to n, it doesn't have to worry about an infinite loop because it knows that it can't overflow because it would be signed. So it's a very tiny thing that actually could improve performance a little bit. Strange, but interesting, I thought.
Evren, would you recommend that even in straight C on the CPU?
Mm-hmm. I was reading an interesting blog post by the LLVM guys, and they were talking about how The one example they gave was how if they know the loop will only execute n plus 1 times, that they don't have to worry about an overflow situation, then there's a bunch of optimizations they can use because of that. So here's a graph from the textbook that shows performance for some of the things we're talking about. So on the left-hand side of the graph, you can see that improvements with loop unrolling, which is the second, third, and fourth bars, don't do a lot. And that's because we're probably saturated by memory bandwidth at this point. Our tiles are so small that we're making too many requests, so memory can't keep up. On the other hand, though, if we increase the tile size, you can see that loop unrolling can have a big impact. And I think that's up to 20% in some cases. Another thing that you see here is these 1x4, 1x2, 1x1. And that's because of something called thread granularity, which is what we're going to talk about next. The idea here is that threads don't necessarily have to compute just one value. So before, when you're using examples for matrix multiply and parallel reduction, you're seeing that each thread was either doing one sum or one dot product. And then we would allocate one thread, allocate as many threads as our problem size is. But that might not necessarily be the most efficient way of doing things. So we might, in fact, get more performance if we make our threads compute more than one value for reduction, or multiple dot products for the matrix multiply. And the following slides I have here are from a guy, a PhD student at Berkeley named Vasily Volkov. And his research is on accelerating linear algebra on the GPU. And he's given a lot of interesting insight as to how performance can improve when you pull something like this. And the main idea he has is what we call unrolling the parallel loop. which is a bit of a transition from what we just talked about. What he means is that, say you have an n-squared problem, for instance, where you have a top loop and a bottom loop, maybe like your flocking example, for instance. What we were doing before is executing the inner loop straight sequentially, and then the outer loop, we would just assign one thread per element. But instead, if we give multiple threads the job of doing the outer loop as well, then we might in fact see some performance gains. So in his example here now, he's going to use half as many threads and twice as much work. So from his talk, he was computing a Gauss-Jordan elimination for solving equations with matrices. And the actual code, I guess, isn't very important. But now he's doing two copies to shared memory from global memory for the matrix. And he's also doing, and he's also computing two instructions and doing two outputs for each one of his threads. And he's also, by the way, using that pragma unroll to unroll that Littner loop entirely. And we can see here, we can actually have some dramatic speed up. So on the x-axis, you can see the number of entries that he's being, that he's computing per thread. So at the most, at around 8 or 16 values computed per thread, he can get up to a 2.6x speed up. So what is the rationale behind this? And one of the interesting slides that I saw was the number of instructions that are executed per thread block. He said that if you measure per just instruction thread, you're not going to see very interesting results. But if you look at it from the thread block standpoint, we are spending a lot less time on control instructions. We have less threads executing less loop counters, less sync thread barriers, and so on. And so we're cutting that side down, and our flops are staying constant, and our shared memory accesses are staying constant instead. So we're computing less we're doing less instructions. And another thing they're doing is allowing more thread blocks to execute in parallel. And because of that, we can get better performance this way. And you can see, actually, it's a similar effect to classical loop unrolling, where you have less control instructions and more of the actual load stores and computations themselves. Any questions on this?
Did he show a bell curve at some point where you get diminishing returns because you keep doing more and more work?
Not for this talk, he didn't. You can see from some of his other talks too that he tends to go on the aggressive note for some of them. And at one point, he was even quoting stuff from the CUDA programming guide and just saying fallacy right underneath it. Because he was finding cases where occupancy, in fact, wasn't leading to the best performance. So for some of his kernels, for instance, he got himself down to 10% or 3% occupancy. You saw in earlier lectures that CUDA occupancy calculator that would show how many threads or blocks you could allocate on the system. And he could get more performance with less occupancy by doing more work for thread. So the main point that we want to get is it's all about trade-offs. There isn't really a one rule that says increasing occupancy will get you better performance or lowering register count will get you better performance. In fact, for his examples, boosting the register usage, and we'll see later as to why using that instead of shared memory could change things, can actually increase performance. So we have trade-offs with thread count, blocks, registers, the size of the shared memory that we're allocating, and instruction size. So it can get very complicated in terms of analyzing what exactly is taking the most time in your code. And probably the easiest thing to do is to use something like the visual profiler, which you might discuss later, on how exactly you can see where the performance bottlenecks are. Okay, so that ends the part about discussing instruction optimizations. Any questions on any of the things we've covered so far? Okay. So next we're going to talk about shared memory. And you know from before that shared memory is a fast pool of on-chip memory that is located next to the SM. And we allocate it per block. An interesting note is that it's actually a bit slower than the SM itself. If you look at the specs for something like Fermi, for instance, you will see that there are two clocks in the system. One is called the base clock, and another is called the shader clock. The shaders themselves, the actual ALUs that do the computations, are running at double the clock speed of the rest of the components, like the schedulers, the SMs, the caches, and pretty much everything else. And so everything is designed such that the schedulers will only operate 1 clock what the shaders need in every 2 clocks. So it'll all sync up like that. And the reason I say this is because now the registers, which are operating at the shader clock, are actually faster than shared memory. And this is why he was a big advocate of using registers instead. But of course, using shared memory is a lot bigger, and you could get better performance if you allocate your threads differently. So it's still no one size fits all. And so we can see here for the G82, we have a bunch of different numbers that we have to keep in mind. The number of thread block slots that we have per SM, number of thread slots, the registers that we can use, and the 16K of shared memory that's allocated to us. The thing we want to talk about now is something called bank conflicts that can occur whenever you're accessing shared memory. And the reason that we have bank conflicts is because the shared memory is divided into banks. And the banks are such that we've split up the memory into, in G80's case, 16 different pieces. And can you think of any reasons as to why it would be split up as banks? As opposed to saying just one large read port to your access seeds for the shared memory.
Is it fast enough to access using banks?
In a sense, if we have multiple banks, if we have 16 banks, now 16 things can potentially access it in parallel. The alternative is if we have 16 read ports, where each read port could access the entirety of shared memory. That sounds like, yeah, it's exactly a lot more complicated. You have to do interconnect to go across this entire thing. And you have to have interconnect to go across the entire thing. So it's cost prohibitive to do something like that. With banks instead, we have a nice compromise. For a lot of good cases, we can get a perfect parallel performance of 16 reads in parallel at once. For some cases, though, we'll have to serialize the access. And that's what we'll see next. So each bank, and this applies to both G80 and Fermi, can service one address per every 2 cycles. And those are 2 shader clock cycles. So it's what I was mentioning before, that all these components do one thing per cycle on their clock. But since the shader clock is double, we have to account for that. And per those 2 cycles, we can access 1 float. And each bank is split up to be the size of a float. So each 32-bit word gets a different bank if we're going in row major order. Any questions about this? So a bank conflict is what happens when we access the same bank at the same time, so 2 simultaneous accesses. What happens then is that the hardware has to serialize them. So it'll service 1 request, return the result, and then only do the 2nd request. So in terms of how many requests can go in parallel, we see that the G80 or the GT200, which are the 8800 GTX and the GTX 280, they have 8 SPs occurring in parallel, which you've seen before with when seeing the SM for the G80, and they have 16 bank shared memories. Fermi, on the other hand, has 16 CUDA cores all executing the same warp at the same time, and 32 banks. So this might be a bit of a tricky question, but how many threads at once can have a bank conflict for, say, the G80? So remember that the 8 SPs are executing at double the rate of the shared memory, and each SP is executing 1 thread. So how many accesses could we have per 2 clock cycles? So we'd have 16 because on clock zero, we're going to have 8 SPs doing the access. And on clock one, we'll have another 8. So we have a half warp that could conflict because they're all trying to access shared memory with different with the same addresses. On Fermi, how many threads could conflict now that we have 32 and 16 instead of 8 and 16? Right. So a full warp can actually bank conflict on Fermi. So you could see that's actually somewhat of a bigger problem. So can you tell me whether either of these cases have bank conflicts? Ideas? Remember, a bank conflict is whenever two threads trying to access the same bank. Yeah, exactly. They're both fine. Everything is accessing a unique bank, so all is well. How about this one? Yeah. We have what are called two-way bank conflicts on the left side because we have two threads accessing the same bank. And on this side, we have 8-way bank conflicts because 8 different threads are accessing the same bank. And one important distinction I want to make is bank versus address. Because what we can actually see the hardware do is in a couple of slides. So, yeah, but we've seen this where half warps access different banks. What we see is that whenever they're accessing the same address, the hardware actually has the ability to broadcast that value to all guys who want the same address. So if they want the exact same float, then we actually don't have a conflict. But these are all deep, of course, because we have 16 here, 16 going this way. So if they access two different floats within the same bank, then we're going to have a conflict. Any questions about this? Okay. So when we have multiple threads accessing the same bank, we have to serialize them then. So we see here that two different threads want to access bank zero. So if we have an n-way bank conflict, where n threads are wanting to access the same bank, what is the cost for that? In terms of cycles. Yeah, it's on the order of n, right? So this can be a severe problem when we want to access shared memory. Okay, so we have an example here, and this is something straight out of the Pebble Reduction Playbook 2, where we're using some base index. We're taking our thread ID, multiplying it by some stride, and then using that to access shared memory. So this is also kind of a tricky question. What values of S would we not have conflicts for? We saw earlier that if S was 2, we'd have two-way bank conflicts because one would wrap around. Shoutouts, any values of S you think wouldn't have conflicts?
One
would not, right? Would 16? Because, yeah, I think so. The main point we wanted to get was that, actually, I'm not sure if 16, but from the CUDA programming guide, we have that if it is a multiple of, say, the number of banks divided by, what is it, the divisor of 32 and S. That's the complicated way of saying it. The easier way of saying it is that if we use an odd stride, we actually wouldn't have any conflicts. So in this example here, S equals 1, everything works okay. And S equals 3, what we're going to have is because it doesn't evenly divide, because S and the index don't evenly divide, then it's going to wrap around to bank 1 on this way. And because of that modular remainder on the other way, it's not going to have conflicts. So if we use odd number strides instead, we can avoid this issue. another interesting solution I saw was if you had a, let's say your shared memory array was 2D. What you can do is pad it with one column. And because of that, whenever you want to do an access, everything's going to be offset for the next row by a float. And that way, you can prevent bad conflicts that way. Any questions about these? So here's some interesting questions. Any ideas on how we could figure out if bank conflicts are being a detriment to our performance without using something like a profiler? We know that bank conflicts only occur for certain scenarios, and we know there's explicit scenarios where bank conflicts do not occur. How can we use that fact to see performance differences?
Think about a very small tweak you're doing your code, assuming we have the same answers.
Well, that would tell you the performance. That would tell you the performance of your current code. But how would you check to see if bank conflicts itself are the problem?
Well, you make the slight modification to. In the beginning, you have the bank conflicts, and then you make the slight modification to remove them.
Yeah, there you go. So one thing you can do is make all the accesses to the same address. We know because of the broadcast feature that if all of our threads are accessing the same address, it'll parallelize it for us and broadcast that value to every thread, so we don't have to wait. So we can make little changes like that, time it once, time it after we do that, see the difference, and see whether bank conflicts are something that we need to work on in our program. Another interesting question is what happens whenever something writes to a shared memory address, if more than one thread writes to the same address. Any ideas on what would happen? In fact, they don't even wait their turn. So one of them gets to do it, which one is undefined. So watch out for that when you're writing programs. All right, so that ends the little piece on shared memory. Any questions about optimizing for shared memories? The next topic is building a bit off of what we were talking about earlier with global memory. And this is something called partition camping. And it builds off of what we were talking about with bank conflicts for shared memory, because these are kind of bank conflicts when accessing global memory. And the reason is that global memory is divided into 6 or 8 partitions of 256 bytes in size. And ideally, we'd want to spread out our accesses to all the different partitions. So that way we can maximize parallelism when doing the accesses to memory itself. So, excuse my lame attempt at a joke. The question is, how are, not in the shared memory, in the shared memory case, we are wondering how are our threads accessing the different banks of shared memory? Now we're not thinking of things at the thread level anymore, but instead at the half warp. Whenever a half more, because we know from the last performance talk that we should coalesce all of our accesses within a half warp so that they're all doing linear addresses. Now, above that level, where should the different half warps be accessing, doing their coalesced accesses in order to maximize performance? So we can see, for example, here in this image that they're writing to the array, and we can see that blocks 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are all being written on the same partition of global memory. So that can act as a severe impediment to performance. And I think the reason for this, although I haven't verified this to be sure, is because of the different memory controllers that we have. So each memory controller is best equipped to act to handle certain dies that it's connected to in the memory so that it could get the best performance for those. Okay, So any questions on the problem of partition capping? The fix I found is clever and very tricky. So what we can do is, instead of doing straight up Cartesian coordinate axes, so we can see on this left-hand side of the grid here, we're, think of each one of these blocks as an individual thread block. And each thread block is accessing a different part of global memory. So we're addressing our thread block 0, 0 all the way to 3, 3 in the normal Cartesian plane. And we're doing the same axes that way in global memory. What we do instead is change the block index so that it suddenly becomes diagonal in terms of the axes. So now we have 0, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, and 3, 0 going across a diagonal instead of down a row. And the reason for this is that while we don't know how the GPU is going to schedule our different thread blocks, we have an idea that things can will initially go sequentially. So if we make sure that sequential thread blocks will access different partitions, then we can improve the performance in terms of partitioning the global memory. And so this little snippet of code right here will do exactly that. It'll diagonalize your addresses. So by flipping the X and Y block addresses and then summing them and modding it with the grid dimension, you can get that. So all you really have to do to implement this kind of fix is just change every time you reference block IDX.x with block IDX underscore X and just apply these two lines of code at the top of your kernel. So it's a very simple fix, but of course, this might not be a problem for many different kinds of applications. So you can see in this output example here what happens now. So we're writing 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on a diagonal across. So we're moving across different partitions. So the performance is improved by that. Okay, and this partition camping is actually not a problem at all in Fermi. So you don't even have to worry about this for when writing Fermi code. This is also a bit of a weird question, but any ideas as to how, without changing the software, how at the hardware level they might actually fix this? Or maybe an intermediate software step of sorts. So what they actually do is hash all the global memory addresses that you're using. So applying the right hash, we can randomize where different memory locations are, and that way we can evenly split it across partitions. So under the hood is hashing it so that it splits it across evenly, but as a programmer you don't have to worry about
it. So, how do you know if your GPU is the hashing thing versus still having that?
So it's the Fermi class and above. So you'll have to check, if you're a programmer, you're going to have to check. In fact, you probably have to do this for a lot of different CUDA applications if you're trying to get the best performance, is do one of the device query calls to figure out exactly what GPU you're using. And it'll at least tell you whether it's Fermi class or not.
And so you are on the Fermi class, so that you are on the Fermi class card, and
I imagine not, since it's hashing the addresses anyways. So whether you access it this way or the other way, it's still going to try to, it's, your addresses are still going to be evenly distributed. So it should be okay, I think. But I might have to think more on that and see if that actually be the case. This whole thing is from a little snippet in a guide to optimizing matrix transpose. So there isn't a lot of details on the exact subject of how to do this. But it is a definite problem. It improved the performance of their transpose implementation by 4x. Any other questions on partition camping? Okay. The next global memory optimization we're going to talk about is actually memory on the host side. And this is page locked host memory. And the idea that we're doing here is essentially removing a chunk of memory from the virtual memory subsystem of the host. We're going to pin the memory such that it's always, the pages are always going to stay at the same location on physical RAM. And, okay, and the next slide will say why. So, because of that, the CUDA driver will always know where this memory is, and it can actually start optimizing instructions and cache for things like memcopy and malloc and CUDA malloc and CUDA free for these different cases, because they know where the page is all the time. So another benefit that we're going to see next is doing data transfer, so doing the memcopy and the actual kernel execution at around the same time, so we can overlap them. Another benefit that we see is systems with a front-side bus. So earlier in the semester, we talked about different system architectures, and we were showing earlier a Sandy Bridge architecture. And the difference there was that both the memory and the GPU were actually, and the GPU were both actually hooked up to the CPU itself. So this was the case, well, not the GPU part at least, for all the Core i7s and Athlon 64s and above that you sell on the market. If you had an older system, like say a Core 2 Duo or something like that, you'd have a front-side bus architecture. So there's a bus called the FSB that connects the CPU to a chip called the Northbridge here, and that's where the memory is connected and that's where the GPU is connected. So whenever you have to do a memcopy for a system like this, the CPU has to coordinate it, right? So data has to go from the memory bus over to the front side bus of the CPU and back around to the GPU. If we pin it so we know exactly where the memory is, we have the potential to just go across this way. And so we save a bit of our travel. Another optimization that we can make is enabling an option two-page lock memory called write combining. And what this means is that it's disabling the caching behaviors for the page lock memory. So the L1 and L2 caches on the CPU will not contain data from these pages that we've pinned. And also, what's the reasoning for this? So we don't have to check. The system is no longer going to go across the PCIe. The GPU, for instance, will not go across the PCIe bus and see if the CPU is accessing this memory. And because of that, we're avoiding the snooping traffic across the PCI Express bus. And we can actually improve performance by a lot with our memory. The problem that we have here is that reading from this memory on the host side or even on the device side is very slow. So all we should really do to it is just write to the host. And we can achieve a lot more performance that way. And the last point on a lot of benefits of page lock memory is that you can actually map into the address space of the device. So there's a function call that you can use. And I guess this is not as relevant in CUDA 4 because there's actually a unified address space between the CPU and the GPU. But in older cases, and the concept itself is still relevant, you can directly access memory with pointers that might have been allocated on the host without doing a mem copy all the way to the GPU memory. So can you think of any systems where this could actually be a big performance boost, where you don't have to copy the data to the GPU memory before using it? So who here knows what integrated graphics are?
Like Intel was.
Exactly. So Intel has them. NVIDIA actually used to make them as well, back in the Core 2 Duo days. And then Intel got into a nice licensing fight with them, and they no longer do that. But when you have an integrated graphics system, then an integrated graphics... Let's see if I can pick the... Right here. So in an integrated graphics system, there's no GPU here. It's actually built as part of this chip here. And on newer integrated graphics systems like Sandy Bridge, for instance, the GPU is here because this chip is largely becoming irrelevant. So with an integrated graphics system, we have the CPU and the integrated graphics sharing the same bus to memory. So they're using the same memory as well. So there's no reason to copy things back and forth, because it's going to the same chip anyways. Any questions about this?
Wait. You can't run
So there are integrated graphics chips that can actually run CUDA. I think a lot of the somewhat older MacBook Pros, for instance, have the 9400M. So I think that's a fairly popular one, and those can all run CUDA. Anything that's 8 series or above. And this will actually become extremely relevant over the next few years, because we're going to see chips that have so-called heterogeneous architectures. Has anybody seen anything in the news about things like that? Yeah, that's a sore subject. But my mom actually has these in one of her laptops. These are called the AMD Fusion chips, for instance. And they started out with these little chips that would go into netbook class laptops. And they have two cores that are each a little more powerful than an Intel Atom. But on the same die itself, there's a full-fledged AMD 6 series GPU. And so you can actually, on some of the desktop level parts, you can actually kind of play games on this chip, which is pretty cool to have a chip this big that can both do CPU stuff and graphics stuff at the same time. The big advantage of that is not only are they sharing the same memory controllers and address space, there's actually buses between the CPU and GPU, so they can share data that way across very high-speed connections. On Sandy Bridge, for instance, which also has an on-die integrated GPU, they share the same L3 cache. So when you have that level of integration, making sure that you're not memcopying things can definitely improve performance. And trying to find new ways of using the interconnects between the two devices will become very, very important as these become more and more popular. The end of the day is, for a company like AMD, for instance, they only want you to buy one chip. You know, that's their combined thing. Yeah?
So they move in a direction where they're trying to put GPUs on, processors.
Yeah,
like
and... Yeah, that's actually, so last week AMD had their financial analyst presentation, and they showed the company is actually gradually shifting. They realized they can no longer compete with Intel on the high-end CPUs, so what they're instead doing is leveraging things that they have that Intel doesn't have. For instance, GPU technology, which is leagues above Intel's at the moment. So they push what they're calling a heterogeneous system architecture, where eventually, we're going to see larger and larger GPUs and CPUs being connected on the same die, but to the point where, right now, for instance, you guys are all CUDA programmers. You see how much of a pain it is to actually extract performance out of this thing. Imagine, though, whenever all you have to do is just write the same code, and the system can optimize for you whether or not to send it to your set of vector processors on the GPU or just leave it running on the CPU. You don't have to worry about that anymore. It's back to the days where we have free performance again. So we're going to see a big shift towards those things. And on the NVIDIA side, there's potential that they're looking to put a CPU on their GPU. So take that for what it's worth as well.
So if CPU and GPU are combined together, so there's an interaction between CPU and GPU. So like the limitation in the kernel functions, like no recursion and no malloc, would that be eliminated?
Those things are already gone. If you use something like Fermi, you can use recursion. You can also use new and delete, I believe, in kernel code. So a lot of those limitations are already being broken. So Fermi is one of the biggest advancements in terms of GPU compute. And in a few months, we're going to see NVIDIA's next generation part. And we'll see what else they have in store on that front. And if you study something like Larrabee, which we may or may not talk about, that also pushed GPU compute in a very, very different direction from what was going on. Okay, so these, for your reference, are functions that will actually do page lock memory allocation for you. So CUDA host alloc and CUDA malloc host, as confusing as they are, actually do the same thing. So use whichever. Host alloc allows you to add additional flags if you want. Like we were talking about the write combining flag and some other flags. Use that other function to free. And then the async memcopy function there allows you to overlap the kernel execution with the memory transfer. So there are some other catches with page lock memory. And the big thing is that if you start removing pages from your virtual memory system, that means there's a lot less pages that the OS can actually use to move memory around. So if you have a 4 gigabyte system and you allocated 3 gigs as page lock memory, that means your OS only has 1 gig to play around with. And that can definitely cause a lot of system instability the further you go. So be careful about something like this. So remember that whenever you allocate something as page lock, you're removing it from your system, in a sense. Any questions about this point? So the one nice advantage that page lock memory gives us is the ability to use something called streams. So streams are very straightforward in themselves in that they're just a sequence of commands that we can execute. Some of those commands being a kernel launch, and others being a memory allocation or a copy. So as long as we execute the streams, each stream itself in order, we can reorganize which parts of the stream get executed. And the next pictures might be more helpful for that. So is this a possible way that these streams could be executed? We have pretty much stream A being executed the whole way in stream B. Yeah, this is the most straightforward case, right? We're just executing things sequentially as if streams are never there in the first place. There's this one. And then this one is just the flip of the two. So we just have B, then A. Now this is a different example. Will this work out? So what we're doing here is executing command 0 for each stream, then command 1, then command 2. So we're still keeping the streams themselves in order. We're just interleaving the two. And that's an optimization that streams can help us.
Why?
Yeah. So in our typical examples of how we've been executing CUDA code, we've memcopied. Let's say we're doing stuff on giant matrices, for instance. We've memcopied the matrices that we've made on the host to the device. We've done our computation on them and then copied it back. So all those things have to go sequentially. But the GPU has the ability to have that copy and a kernel be executed at the same time. So say there are two kernels that we want to execute now, and those are part of streams A and B. So let's say A's data has already been copied. Then we can execute the kernel for A while copying the data for B. So that way we can get some parallelism out of it. So since we can do both, we can extract more. And cards like Fermi can actually execute up to 16 kernels themselves in parallel. So if you can't get a good device utilization out of your kernel itself, and you need to do multiple things, then you could actually execute multiple kernels at the same time and get better performance that way. So now, is this a possible stream execution pattern? Right, it's out of order. So we're executing command 2 before command 1, which is not allowed. The streams have to be executed in order. This would be saying, for instance, doing the copy from device back to host before you've actually executed the kernel.
What if they're independent?
Because you've put them all in the same stream, it's not going to know. They're just commands that have to be executed. So it's not going to do any of the reordering for you. If you want to execute the streams in parallel, we'll see in a second, you have to do it yourself. So the commands that go in a stream are kernel launches and memory copies that we've just seen. So the example again is we copy our data that we need to compute on from our host to our device card. We do our computation, and then we copy the results back from device to host. So the code example we're going to have here is we create a couple of streams. We copy our page lock memory onto the device itself, launch the kernel, copy the results back, and then we destroy the stream. So we have a special type for streams. And so we create the streams there. We malloc the data with CUDA malloc host so that it's page locked. Create the streams, allocate the buffers. We want two for the data and the result. Then we're going to do the mem copies with the async call that you saw before. So now since it's asynchronous, it's not a blocking call. And that way we can actually parallelize it with a kernel execution. And then we execute the kernel and then we mem copy back. So these things have to be executed synchronously because you can't copy the data back before you've executed the kernel. But now we have three streams going on. So we can potentially get some parallelism out of that. Okay, so you can see in the example here, you actually stick it within the kernel function call itself, your little triple bracket syntax. You put at the very end the stream that this is going to be part of. So we do that for each stream. And then when we're done, we'll destroy the streams because we're good programmers to clean up. So how can the different streams overlap? So here's the example that we have here. Can we have really more overlap than this in terms of parallelism? I kind of mentioned this already. So Fermi has the ability to do a device to host and a host to device copy at the same time. And I can also execute kernels at the same time too. So this is kind of the ideal case in terms of a normal device or an older device like G80 or GT200, but we can actually extract even more parallelism if we use a card like Fermi. So this example, for instance, wouldn't work on an older card, but it would work on Fermi since we have two kernels executing at the same time. Okay, and so there's a kind of implicit synchronization that goes on because of that. And because this is dependent on this, and this can't execute until that is completed, then we see that this kernel has to finish first, then this copy, and if these copies can't be, so this copy can be done in parallel with that, but then this kernel has to be executed with that copy. Any questions about this? Okay, so the advice to give, and this is from the programming guy, is that we want to issue all of our independent commands first, because that way the streams can parallelize them right away for us. And whenever you want to synchronize everything, try to keep that away from as long as possible, of course. Just like using something like locks, for instance, avoid them if you can. So this is the code that we had before, and kernels cannot actually execute in parallel in this, right? Because, so we're doing our mem copy for stream 0, our kernel execution for stream 0, and then the copy back for stream 0, and then only are we doing the copy 2 for stream 1. So because these are dependent, this copy could at most be parallel. This copy for stream 1 could at most be in parallel with stream 0. So copy back. And it can't. The kernels themselves can't be in parallel because of those dependencies. So we'll see. Any ideas on how you would rearrange this so that the kernels would execute in parallel instead? Get the code example itself here. So what we can do is first do the mem copies themselves. So for each stream, copy the code onto the device. Then for each stream, execute the kernels. And then for each stream, copy back. So we still have the dependency, the serial dependency that we need for each stream, that you have to copy first, execute the kernel, and then only you can copy your results back. That is impossible to get around. But at least now, since our kernel commands are executed within right next to each other, we can parallelize the kernel execution. Which one will actually get more performance, though, might be dependent on the actual length of how long it takes your kernel to execute versus how long it takes to copy your data. We can also explicitly synchronize whenever we have streams. We don't have to wait for blocking commands to hold them. So if we do something like a CUDA thread synchronize, it makes sure that all threads and all streams have finished computing and have their results, and only then we can proceed. So these are useful, for instance, for timing scenarios, so that we know exactly when our CUDA computation is done. And we can also do a stream synchronize to just wait for all events in the one particular stream to occur. Okay, that is actually everything. Any questions on streams, shared memory, instruction mixes, threads, the homework?
Has everyone started on the homework at this point?
If you see the, yeah, I empathize, I didn't study it either. If you look in the README for the flocking project itself.
There's some like Python code and to calculate like distance and all the things, but you give us a floating point for matter, how to compute that?
So all those algorithms should be extendable. Of course, it's not a 4D implementation, right? The fourth point should just be 0 or 1, but the other three dimensions, you should be able to extrapolate as to how you
get it. Yeah, there's the algorithm like when one is there, you have to calculate the neighbors. There's the, it's not whole round, it's just the angles. Mm-hmm. And if you extend it to 3D, how do you do that? I have no idea about that. So
look at the implementation and see.
Which implementation?
Like That link you're talking about has example code as to how to implement that cohesion.
They only give the function like a distance and give neighbors and
mm-hmm. So what's the difference between calculating distance in 2D and 3D?
Okay. So we don't have to give like part of like the angle.
No.
Okay.
Other questions for Varun? So just a couple comments on my end. I'm glad that there's a lot of interest here in this class and about all the stuff Varun said about Fermi. And we'll see that the GPU does get easier to program with Fermi when you talk about, hey, can we do recursion and can we do dynamic memory allocation? And I'm really excited that there's a lot of interest here between, as Varun said, either putting a CPU on a GPU or putting a GPU on a CPU, which in the general community we call system on a chip, or SOC. You'll see that acronym a lot. And towards the end of the semester, we will talk quite a bit about that. We're going to talk, and then we'll talk about mobile. We'll also be relevant there. And, you know, 3 years from now in this class, you know, we said 10, I think probably sooner than 10, but even like 3 years from now, this class may change quite a bit when that is very, very dominant out there. So I'm glad you guys are definitely interested in the trends that we see coming here. The other things is the student presentations. If you haven't sent it to me, like you're already late, so you can try to send it to me and see if it's still okay. But I'm going to send out the schedule tomorrow morning for you guys. And then I'll give you like a day or two if you have something like, yeah, I'm a PhD student, and if I don't submit this paper, I'm going to get kicked out of school. So I need to change my date. Then, you know, you can send it. Then we can talk about switching your date. Or, you know, my wife is pregnant, she's due that day. But in general, you know, switching the date is not something that we're gonna like do a lot of, and certainly like a week before your presentation, you can't come to do it. Well, I saw a spring break and I was partying, and now I don't have time to do this presentation. Like that's not gonna fly. So you're gonna have to do it up front right away with a good, legit reason. And then finally, this Monday we have a guest lecture from Tim Calvin talking about GPU research, and this is like consider this course material. So it will be on the homework, potentially it will be on the final. However, all of your student presentation topics, you are not responsible for that on the final. That'd be crazy. That'd be a good experiment, but we're not going to experiment this semester on that. Yes?
Do we have to relate to the GPU, like in graphics topics also? Like, do we have to make mentioned something about the GPU.
In your student presentations? Yes. Absolutely. It absolutely has to be relevant to the GPU. It has to be. It can be XYZ algorithm on the GPU. Right? Like the example I gave in class the other day was like, it's like a general talk on machine learning is interesting in general, but it's not interesting for this class. But a talk on running machine learning algorithms, like for example, K-means, on the GPU would be completely, completely relevant. Yep.
So are we required to go deep into the detailed algorithms in our presentation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I will send out an outline for you, probably either 1 or probably 2 weeks before the talk. I'll try to get them all out pretty early. To kind of give you a general sense for what I think would be most relevant on your topic for the class. But loosely speaking, I probably care more about breadth than I do about individual depth. You know what I mean? Like, especially when you have 20 or 25 minutes, I don't know how deep you're going to go. But you don't want to be so shallow such that it's, you know, it's hand wavy and we don't gain anything. Other questions about presentation? Great, okay. Well, thanks a lot, Ron. That's great. We'll see you guys on Monday.
It's actually pretty nice.